5 days of indiscriminate Israeli attacks on Gaza claimed the lives of more than 1,000 Palestinians, including 260 children. Iran's president says Israel's war crimes against Palestinians with the U.S. green light will bring destructive insecurity upon the regime and its backers. The Arab League strongly condemns Israel's brutal aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip as collective punishment and violation of international law. Hello everyone, thank you for tuning in to World News. The Israeli regime continues indiscriminate aerial strikes on Gaza Strip for a fifth straight day, killing more people in besieged Palestinian territory. Scores of Palestinians have lost their lives in fresh Israeli attacks on Gaza, pushing the death toll to over 1,200, including scores of children. Attacks have left more than 5,600 people injured as well. Israel's pounded Gaza's commercial zones, residential areas, and refugee camps. Gaza is under full Israeli siege, and now only power plant there has shut down due to a fuel outage. According to the health authorities, overwhelmed hospitals without electricity are relying solely on emergency generators, which will only last about 2 to 4 days. And our correspondent Ashraf Shannon joined us earlier from Gaza amid intense Israeli bombardments. He said the regime has virtually disconnected the densely populated territory from the outside world.
Any moment now, because there's nothing coming in. The Rafah crossing in the southernmost tip of Gaza with Egypt is open, basically, from the Egyptian side. From the Palestinian side, which is separated right now from between the people. Israel is unable to attack the Egyptian side of the crossing. There is a peace agreement between Israel and Egypt. So they hit the Rafah crossing from the Palestinian side. They hit it with a small rocket earlier. So people are afraid. People are afraid to even reach the crossing. Even those who manage to go there are having it's impassable right now. Something crazy. This is something crazy that's taking place, and no one is paying attention to it because of corporate media. Corporate media that's around the world is controlled by the Israeli regime. Everyone knows it. Even in the United States, they know that the Israeli regime is controlling corporate media. Whatever you see on Islamic Republic of Iran channels, you cannot see anywhere else because no one is showing this. Here in Gaza, we have international news agencies working. They've filmed everything, and they give their material, the silver materials, to all the news channels, but none of the things that happen is aired.
Israeli forces have fatally shot another Palestinian teenager during an overnight raid near the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. According to Palestinian media, 16-year-old Moniz Rebbi Ziyadat died of critical wounds he sustained to the chest by Israeli forces' live fire. New fatality brings the number of Palestinians killed by regime forces in the West Bank alone since Saturday to 29. Around 150 have also been injured. The Hamas resistance movement has called on Palestinians in the West Bank to join its operation against the regime.
Palestinians in the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah took to the streets again on the fifth consecutive day of Israel's war on the besieged Gaza Strip. The horrific footage from Gaza over the past days cannot help but shock, protesters say.
The airstrikes and the massacres being carried out in the Gaza Strip is under the protection of the American administration. And what's going on is terrifying. Israel cut the water and the electricity. People will not have access to food and fuel. Israeli occupation army is shelling residential buildings, and they're evacuated. Children, women, and elderly are killed and remain under the rubble. These images hurt the feelings. But unfortunately, we're speaking about a cruel enemy. Nothing will affect them. They're killers.
We Palestinians hold the same blood here in Ramallah and in Gaza, but it is their destiny that they are on the battlefield. Gazans hold the Arab and Islam flag. They continue to keep the Arab heads up. The least to do today is to take part in the protests and demonstrations. The least to do is going to the military checkpoints and areas where settlements are and clash with them. Our blood is one, and we are in the same path.
People were chanting for the Gaza Strip and for Hamas fighters while they were touring the main streets of Ramallah. Since the start of the Israeli war on the Gaza Strip, Palestinians say they struggle to live normal lives. As the streets were really eerie, Palestinian officials who were taking part in the rally pointed out that the bloodiest operation in Gaza requires immediate international intervention to protect the Gazans, who have been suffering for years because of the Israeli blockades and wars.
Today, all forms of comprehensive resistance must be adopted. This war has literally united people of different political affiliations, and with our unity, we can fight the genocidal war. This genocide is being carried out by the fascist Israeli regime. Today, it's urgently needed to address the United Nations to ensure the protection of Gaza residents. We must also work on prosecuting the Israeli regime for the crimes committed against the Palestinian people.
Israel has imposed a full lockdown, which tightens the grip on the daily lives of the residents of the occupied West Bank. A heavy military presence has converged all over the West Bank, preventing transporting between West Bank areas because of the closure of military checkpoints. Since Saturday, Israeli forces have killed over 25 Palestinians and wounded a few hundred others. Many of them were taking part in pro-Gaza rallies.
Protests against Israel's war on the besieged Gaza Strip have spread all over Palestinian territories. However, while Israel's onslaught on Gaza goes on unabated, more Palestinians are being killed in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
And we spoke to our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Saleh, about the serious impact of operations carried out by Hamas and Hezbollah resistance movements on Israeli military.
The Israelis are in a state of not only they're not just hysterical, they're paranoid. Today, three, four reports, more than that, I think, came out of the Israeli media and were baseless. First, they say there's a group of drones being sent by Hezbollah. Then they say there's infiltrators from Hezbollah or Palestinian resistance of fighters. Then they say there's a security issue. Then the sirens kept sounding on and on. The UNIFIL were always on high alert because of the Israeli paranoia. So it seems that the Israelis are really in a tight spot now. They're being cornered, and they always fear, like, they're working in Gaza. There's a war in Gaza, they're shooting, and of course the Palestinian resistance is doing everything it can to try to defend that area. But at the same time, they feel that their back is not secured. Now, we heard from Netanyahu saying that they're getting all the weapons, all the support. You have the naval carrier, you have Gerald Ford coming for their rescue. Gerald Ford for Lebanon is considered something that was clear symbolism of U.S. atrocities against Lebanon. They only launched aggressions against Lebanon, but as a result, we had the Marines operation and the killing of over 200 U.S. Marines in Lebanon. So I think the United States also understands that it needs to bring that, to try to bring some sort of deterrence, some sort of equilibrium to face Hezbollah, because they believe, perhaps it seems, that U.S. looks at Hezbollah as an equal to the U.S. Army.
Colin Campbell is our correspondent in Washington, and we asked him if there is a blowback from American people against the U.S. decision to provide military assistance to Israel.
The U.S. is expected to be unwavering in its support and not really step back from that. We heard a speech from the U.S. President Biden earlier this week, just a couple days ago, talking about his support and seemingly not stepping back from that. We even saw big posters or his image on the Jumbotron thanking him for sending that aid over, pledging support. So of course, we in the U.S. are questioning some of these motives, where there have been protests across the nation about the U.S. support and the fact that we send over $3.8 billion every year to aid their military. So you're wondering, well, then how much does the U.S. Plan to actually add or supplement what they're already giving monetarily? And it looks like this is really heavy military equipment here, despite the fact that we have already sent arms and we've sent money and some equipment over to Ukraine. we're still sending other equipment elsewhere, and this will be used against innocent people, even if they call it collateral damage. We know that it will kill innocent people in the end, especially if this this machinery and this equipment is used.
The Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi has stressed the need to end Israel's war crimes against Palestinians during regime's brutal onslaught on the Gaza Strip. In a phone call to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the Iranian president also called for unity among Muslims in the face of the regime's atrocities. He added, Israel's crimes against Palestinians, which are committed with the U.S. green light, will bring destructive insecurity upon the regime and its backers. The phone call was the first between Iran's president and the Saudi Crown Prince since Riyadh and Tehran resumed diplomatic ties following a China brokered deal back in March. Foreign ministers of the Arab League have strongly condemned Israel's brutal aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip. In a statement at the end of their meeting, they described regime's onslaught as collective punishment, which contravenes international law.
The attacks carried out and prepared by the Israeli occupation forces will not bring stability, but will lead us into more cycles of violence and blood. The collective punishments practiced by these authorities against the residents of Gaza are rejected and condemned in international law.
The statement rejected the killing of civilians and terrorizing innocent people as unacceptable, calling for an immediate ceasefire. Arab League also warned about serious possibilities for further deterioration of the situation and expansion of the ongoing military confrontations. The statement added the continuation of the conflict could push the entire region toward an unknown fate. This was the Arab League's first ministerial meeting since the start of Israeli aggression against Gaza. Arab foreign ministers have denounced Israel's siege of the Gaza Strip, demanding aid be immediately allowed to enter the blockaded enclave. And concerns mount over worsening humanitarian situation in Gaza amid relentless Israeli bombardments. Now, the UN Secretary General's call for rapid humanitarian access to the blockaded territory, warning that there is no time to lose.
UN staff are working around the clock to support the people of Gaza, and I deeply regret that some of my colleagues have already paid the ultimate price. Crucial life-saving supplies, including fuel, food and water, must be allowed into Gaza. We need rapid and unimpeded humanitarian access now. There is no time to lose. Every moment counts.
Guterres also thanked Egypt for its constructive efforts to facilitate humanitarian access to the Rafah crossing and to make El Arish airport available for critical assistance. He added hundreds of thousands of Palestinians are now sheltering in 92 UN facilities across Gaza. Guterres stressed those facilities, as well as hospitals, schools, and clinics, must never be targeted. Now, this is Israel has leveled over 1,000 buildings and imposed a total siege on the territory, cutting off food, water, and energy supplies for 2.3 million people. Gaza's sole power plant also shut down Wednesday after running out of fuel. Some countries have called for a humanitarian corridor to let civilians out. Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations has stressed country's determination continue its peaceful ballistic missile and space programs. Amir Saeed Iravani made the remark in a letter to the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and rotating president of the Security Council. He was responding to a letter by French, British, and German envoys who claimed Iran's missile and space programs violated Security Council Resolution 2231. Iravani said resolution has no jurisdiction over those programs. He had both programs fall within the framework of Iran's inalienable rights according to international law and are necessary to safeguard the country's security. Envoy also warned against any political approach to this issue by some Western countries. He said such hypocritical approaches are only meant to violate other countries' right to have their own peaceful space programs. Leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, has arrived in Tehran to a warm reception. Revered as a significant figure within the Muslim community, Zakzaki represents the culture of resistance and fight against oppression.
Tehran plays host to a distinguished visitor. Revered Muslim figure Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki arrived in Tehran for medical treatment among warm welcomes on Wednesday. Crowds of people, having traveled great distances to catch a glimpse of the revered leader, gathered outside the airport bearing welcome placards. Known as the leader of the Shia population in Nigeria, Sheikh Zakzaki has earned acclaim for his steadfast resistance against oppression and his role in propagating Islamic teachings in Nigeria. The Sheikh delivered a brief address to express gratitude to those who came to welcome him upon his arrival.
I'm very pleased and happy to see these faces of people in solidarity with us and the mutual love and interest in what has happened to us. Thank you very much. We thank Allah for giving us the opportunity to have passed this difficult period. And we hope, inshallah, in the near future, the message of the Islamic Republic of Iran will engulf this world. Not only Africa, but beyond the American continent, European continent, until the whole world is ready for the appearance of Imam Mahdi Ajalla Faraja.
Zakzaki's name is closely linked to the name of the founder of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. He became Shia after he met with Imam Khomeini right after the Islamic Revolution in the country.
As long as the culture of resistance is concerned, Sheikh Zakzaki is one of the most important people who has opened a new resistance front in the world. Farzan Ashurian, Tehran.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
The Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas says no negotiations regarding Israeli captives will take place so long as Israel continues with its attacks on the besieged Gaza Strip. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered the story and tells us more. The Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas says an ongoing operation against Israel will continue, while rejecting any negotiations on Israeli captives so long as the regime's attacks on the besieged Gaza Strip continue. Abu Obeidah, the spokesman for the Gaza Strip-based movement's military wing, the Ezzedine al-Qassam Brigades, made the remark in a recorded message late on Monday, 9th of October, warning that the Israeli regime must be ready to pay a high price in exchange for the captives' freedom. The spokesman said, "The matter of prisoners is a strategically crucial issue with a well-defined trajectory, and the occupation will inevitably bear the consequences." Abu Obeidah noted that the resistance fighters have succeeded in apprehending a significant number of the enemy's soldiers at various battlefronts, who have been relocated to Al-Qassam Brigade's detention facilities. Abu Obeidah added, "We categorically refuse to engage in deliberations or negotiations regarding prisoner matters under the duress of aggression, and the enemy must prepare to pay the high price." Abu Obeidah noted that Hamas has launched a military operation against Israel with unwavering resolve and courage, is fully aware of the potential outcomes, and is also prepared for any eventuality. Despite the enemy's possession of advanced security and military technology, they have failed to confront our fighters on the ground for over 60 hours now, the spokesman added. Abu Ubaidah emphasized that the resistance fighters will continue their large-scale operation across multiple locations with constant rotation of forces, the dispatch of reinforcements armed with weapons and equipment, and the capture of more prisoners. He said Hamas fighters have engaged in unrelenting clashes with Israeli forces, culminating in the defeat of the entire Gaza division of the Israeli occupation army on the first day of hostilities. He explained that Operation Al-Aqsa Storm came from the Zionist regime's repression of Palestinians, which had reached its peak through the desecration of the Holy Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. The enemy thought that by closing the Al-Aqsa Mosque to our people and releasing herds of settlers to ignite a religious war, they would escape punishment for their crimes. He also criticized the international community and the United Nations for ignoring the Israeli regime's crimes, saying that large-scale operation against Israel was a response to the occupying regime's acts of aggression against innocent Palestinians. Abu Ubaidah warned the Israeli regime that the era of your triumphs have irrevocably ended, giving way to an era of defeat and setbacks. The Zadin al-Qassam brigades maintain a firm grip on the direction of the battle, underpinned by the efficient command and control system, and are fully prepared to endure for an extended period of time, Abu Ubaidah pointed out. Since Saturday, 7th of October, the Gaza Strip-based resistance group have fired thousands of rockets at the occupied Palestinian territories. On Monday, 9th of October, Hamas lauded the ongoing surprise attack against Israel as a legitimate right of Palestinians in response to the illegal entity's decades-long aggression and the silence of the international community. Hamas has praised the Operation Al-Aqsa Storm as legitimate Palestinian right to self-defense. Hamas made this statement on the third day of Operation Al-Aqsa Storm, the largest military operation against the Israeli regime in decades. The battle of Operation Al-Aqsa Storm is a legitimate right for our people to defend ourselves, to defend our land and our sanctities, in light of the continued aggression of the occupation forces and the silence and failure of the world to put an end to its escalating terrorism and its denial of all rights of the Palestinian people and their aspirations to liberate their homeland and achieve a return to our homeland, the movement said in a statement. CNN Cable News Network has also covered this story and tells us more. The Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas said late on Sunday, 8th of October, to be holding more than 100 hostages in Gaza, including high-ranking Israeli army officers, according to Musa Abu Marzouk, the deputy chief of Hamas's political bureau. Qatar has been in talks with Hamas about the hostages it holds inside Gaza, and the United States has been coordinating with the Qataris as they play a key mediating role with Hamas, a senior U.S. official confirmed to CNN. CNN has reached out to both the governments of Qatar and Israel for comment. Abu Ubaidah, the Zadin al-Qassam Brigade spokesperson, said Hamas will not negotiate on the issue of hostages whilst under Israeli fire. Israeli jets continued to bombard the Gaza Strip with deadly airstrikes on Monday, 9th of October, as the violence continued into a third day. The Zionist regime airstrikes have killed at least 687 Palestinians as of Monday, 9th of October, including dozens of Palestinian children and women, and left thousands injured, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. The Russian news agency TASS has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas says there will be no hostage negotiations as long as fighting continues. "We will not negotiate on the issue of captives under fire from Israeli forces," the Hamas movement said in a statement. The Palestinian Hamas movement has announced that it does not intend to hold any negotiations on the fate of the hostages seized by its forces on Israeli territory near the Gaza Strip, while hostilities continue, according to the Al-Hadath television channel. Hamas representatives will not negotiate on the issue of captives under fire from Israeli forces, the movement said in a statement quoted by the Al-Hadath television channel.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone. Let us ponder on a maxim from Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, to his cousin and first infallible successor, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. O Ali, no poverty is harsher than ignorance, nor fortune better than the intellect, no loneliness desolate than pride, no victory like counseling, no intellect like moderation, no lineage like good manners, and no worship like pondering over things.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, earning a halal income in our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, it is an honor to be here in your service, dear friends. We are talking about earning a halal income in our Islamic lifestyle. So, of course, as many of you know, that earning income is something that is necessary, of course, in the modern age that we live in. And even in past ages, people had to go and work in order to earn some kind of livelihood in order to sustain themselves and their families. Now, in the past, just as today, people really had two ways of earning this livelihood. One was to go about and earn it by halal means, permissible means, and the other one was unfortunately to go about it via haram means, via means that are prohibited, and they are haram, and they're not lawful or legal as far as Islam is concerned. So these were the two ways to earn livelihood. Now, we find that some people, alhamdulillah, they would go, and I think most of the people went, and they earned an income which was halal, it was permissible, it was pure, it was blessed, right? And of course, this is the main foundation of a Islamic lifestyle. Islamic lifestyle promotes purity, cleanliness, spiritual, physical purity, right? A purity and health of the mind and the soul and the body. And so earning an income that is permissible and is halal is really an integral part of a Islamic lifestyle. Welcome back, dear friends. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about earning a halal, permissible income when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle. Now, we talked about how there's two ways to earn income and livelihood. One is halal, which is permissible. And of course, the second one is haram. It is prohibited. Now, when we earn an income which is halal, it is permissible, then the food that we acquire via that income is halal, it is permissible. And of course, there's various different effects that occur, positive effects, spiritual and physical, when our income is halal, it is permissible, it is lawful, and it is acceptable to the Almighty Allah. But on the other hand, if our income is haram, it is prohibited, it is being gained via unlawful and illegal means, as far as Islam is concerned, then that will have clear negative, consequences and repercussions, both on our spiritual state and our physical state. And this consumption of haram income or haram food, or for that matter, this kind of ingestion of anything that is haram, either via our eyes, our ears, our mouths, or our spirit, right? This ingestion of these haram things, they harm the soul and they harm our physical body. And of course, we won't be able to live a proper Islamic lifestyle. So an integral part of our Islamic lifestyle has to be earning a halal, permissible income. And really, all of our inputs have to be halal if we are going to be living a Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
U.S. presence in Afghanistan.
Part 4.
In any country, the judicial system is assigned with fighting corruption. With the start of the Reconstruction period, the Americans promised Afghans that they would establish an efficient judicial system. Eric Holder, the then U.S. Attorney General, talked about the rule of law, complete transparency, and enjoying maximum justice in Afghanistan.
Now, the United States is committed to partnering with Afghanistan to ensure that all Afghan citizens have access to a fair, efficient, and transparent judicial system.
But by the end of U.S. presence in Afghanistan, the indices for justice and the rule of law were in the worst condition. Reports released by the World Justice Project in 2019 and 2020 confirm it. As for the rule of law, Afghanistan ranked 122nd among 128 countries, and as for regulatory enforcement, it was among the 10 worst countries. Finally, in civil justice, it was ranked 123rd among 128 countries. Apart from international reports, the people of Afghanistan were completely dissatisfied with their judicial system introduced by the U.S. According to the report by World Justice Project, the people had the highest degree of distrust in the Afghan judges. That's why most of the people felt like the formal judicial system could not ensure justice, so they prefer the informal judicial system, a network that was traditionally in place to resolve disputes within Afghan society.
In 2016, we conducted a study that aimed at looking at what these perceptions and experiences were like. And we saw that a large number of Afghans were pursuing these informal mechanisms.
Based on the World Justice Project's report, the first thing that came to mind when people regarded the courthouses of Afghanistan was corruption. After the fundamental problems of the Afghan judicial system, the International Court of Justice at The Hague considered the Afghan judicial system completely collapsed because of its absolute inefficiency.
And I'll stop there for a moment. What we do have in Afghanistan is a substantial collapse or unavailability of the national system.
Corruption in the Afghan judicial system was part of the organized corruption within the system caused by the U.S. during the Reconstruction period. The courthouses, the police, and the administrative employees were all part of it.
They wanted a little bit of justice, the Afghan people. So what do? We build courthouses. We hire corrupt judges, corrupt prosecutors, and corrupt officials.
The dark and non-transparent atmosphere in Afghanistan was the best chance for U.S. companies to possess a big chunk of the reconstruction budget. Fox News calls it windfalls of war for the companies. As John Sopko put it, the companies found out the odor of mendacity was coming from Afghanistan.
But there's an odor of mendacity throughout the Afghanistan issue.
Under those circumstances, so much was stolen from the Afghan Reconstruction Fund that John Sopko doesn't exactly know how many billions of dollars was actually stolen.
I can tell you it's in the billions. And I can also tell you it's too much. We've wasted too much. How much has been stolen? I just don't have the time to track that down. It's almost impossible. I know the Wartime Contracting Commission, which was set up by Congress and looked at Iraq and Afghanistan, I think it was a 60, 70 billion they came up, but I don't know where they came up with that number.
The American companies were behind the stealing because neither Afghan politicians nor people had the access to the Reconstruction Fund. No court session was held in the U.S. or anywhere else to deal with the stealing or the corruption in the reconstruction process, except for one court session that was held in Afghanistan in 2014 to handle the case of corruption in reconstruction. The court charged an Afghan. The interesting point is an American testified against him. Eventually, corruption put an end to the 20-year reconstruction. The corruption had its roots in the U.S. Assuming the Afghan reconstruction failed, a question comes to mind. Why did the U.S. government spend money for reconstruction of a poor and war-stricken country like Afghanistan in the first place? In 2019, Afghanistan was the biggest recipient of U.S. foreign aid.
The United States is the world's largest giver in the world, by far, of foreign aid.
In 2020, Afghanistan was a top recipient of U.S. non-military aid. But what was the U.S. after? Humanitarian goals, or was it pursuing another goal? U.S. reconstruction projects are basically in line with an old policy: foreign assistance. Foreign assistance is a strategic tool along the U.S. military and diplomatic forces.
If you look at our foreign assistance as a tool in our national security portfolio, as opposed to charity, then you combined our defense budget overall with our diplomatic budget and our foreign assistance budget, and in that mix, there's a lot more we should be doing.
On the other hand, in order to use the natural resources of a poor country, the U.S. needs to enter that country as a charitable country.
Oftentimes not focused exclusively on poverty alleviation. In fact, it was used to try to forge political alliances and to try to buy access to a country's natural resources.
The goal of accessing natural resources in Afghanistan was defined as striking a balance between reconstruction and the energy resources and mines in the country.
There were a lot of multilateral assessments that were going on at the time that would ultimately drive some of the strategies for the mining and energy sector. When I first stepped foot into Afghanistan, I realized that there are so many projects. One of the best ways to approach our aid would be to regionalize our aid, and we should have reconstituted them. I always say this wasn't a reconstruction effort. This was a construction effort. And we came in thinking, oh, we'll just go to the region and put some money in there, and it'll be back on its feet.
In order to ameliorate and wipe off the military invasion of Afghanistan, the U.S. used foreign assistance as a tool to pursue its political and economic agendas.
It is in America's interest to do the things that we do with foreign assistance. It is in our economic interest. It is in our security interest.
Eventually, the measures turned the country that received support into a consumer of American goods and a political ally of the United States. This is a policy the U.S. implemented after World War II in many European countries, including Germany and Asian countries like Japan and South Korea. The European and Asian countries were economically developed, but at a big cost, and that was their military and political independence was taken away from them.
We've had troops in Europe now for 70 years.
Yeah.
We've had troops in South Korea for 70 years.
The program was supposed to be implemented in the second wave of reconstruction in Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan, but the past experience did not happen again for the U.S.
We haven't learned the lessons of Vietnam. If anything, after Vietnam, we said we're never going to do it, and we cut all of the capabilities to do these type of reconstruction events or activities in a war zone. And lo and behold, we said we're never going to do it again. We did it in Iraq. We did it in Afghanistan.
The U.S. failures in Vietnam and Afghanistan were not similar only in the exit from the embassies, but failure in reconstruction was another factor that Vietnam and Afghanistan had in common. After the reconstruction failure in Afghanistan, the permanent SIGAR organization also came to an end, and Afghan reconstruction case was closed.
I've spent a lot of time over the last number of weeks, and my staff has, trying to get our American SIGAR employees out.
But the U.S. State Department did not allow the last reports on Afghanistan to be published and barred the public from accessing the reconstruction documents.
SIGAR was forced to relegate all of this information into classified annexes.
So John Supko, head of the Investigating Institute, was forced to classify the documents.
Shortly after the fall of Kabul, the State Department wrote to me and other oversight agencies requesting that we, quote unquote, temporarily suspend access to all of our audit, inspection, and financial reports.
Classifying documents apparently means everything is over, and no one should know what happened in reconstruction of Afghanistan.
So the Afghan people really
preferred the Taliban sometimes to the officials that we brought in from the central government.
Why?
That was a serious problem. But to the Afghan people, they actually got justice from the Taliban. So you didn't have to offer, you didn't have to reinvent the wheel, you didn't have to do major programs in these districts to win the hearts and minds of the Afghan people.
The Americans might be able to shred all the realities on papers and demolish them or burn them. They might be able to remove the data from any network or system, and they might be able to secretly take the classified documents out of Afghanistan, but the realities on the ground cannot be shredded or burned and cannot remain classified forever. The realities will one day reveal what happened under the skin of Afghanistan.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
According to data from the U.S. National Water Information System, 50% of domestic wells in the United States have detectable concentrations of uranium. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered this story and tells us more. A new study revealed about 95% of the US population is drinking water from wells and community systems containing unsafe levels of toxic contaminants. Scientists at the University of New Mexico identified at least six pollutants, primarily arsenic, nitrates, uranium, and lead, linked to neurological and developmental problems. Fracking fluids and PFAS was also detected in the drinking water that also flows to the homes of about 320 million Americans. The authors of the report, the six contaminants represent a small fraction of the thousands of chemical agents present in drinking water in the United States. The team also warned that two or more contaminants could be present in a water source, presenting the possibility of synergistic effects. The study published in Nature reads, "The seven contaminants and contaminant groups presented here represent a tiny fraction of the thousands of regulated and unregulated chemical agents present in drinking water." This review illustrates the complexities of the array of chemical hazards in America's drinking water and highlights the need for a concerted effort to invest in upgrading their drinking water infrastructure, strengthening drinking water standards, develop and implement enhanced water treatment, and collect and disseminate monitoring data and require more stringent chemical safety testing to support the welfare of all U.S. residents. The team found arsenic is detectable in more than 50% of community water systems, with 2.6% exceeding the maximum contaminant level. These high levels were found in the U.S. Southwest and Great Plains regions, where hard rock mining processes and mine waste occur. Arsenic has long been flowing through drinking water systems, but while the maximum contaminant level is 0.01 micrograms per liter, parts of the United States have seen higher levels of arsenic. The study highlights that from 2009 through to 2011, the average arsenic concentrations were 1.7 micrograms per liter nationwide. The researchers shared the highest were located in communities categorized as semi-urban, Hispanic, and communities in the southwestern United States. Communities with less than 500 residents, communities reliant on groundwater sources, and incarcerated populations in the southwestern United States. Repeated exposure can damage DNA, weaken the immune system, and lead to the formation of cancer cells, as well as high blood pressure and heart disease. Detections of lead stem from America's history of using the material for water system pipes during the 1800s. However, lead pipes continued to be installed in the United States until they were banned in 1986, including in locales such as Chicago, Illinois, that required lead service line installation until then. The Environment Protection Agency, the EPA, does not have a set of maximum contaminant level, or MCM, for lead, but established a treatment technique requiring systems to control the corrosiveness of their water. If more than 10% of the tap water samples exceed the action level of 0.015 milligrams per liter, water systems must take additional steps, part of the lead and copper rule. The study highlights research conducted in 2021 that found 186 million Americans receive water from CWs with detectable lead contamination, and a majority of these people live in minoritized and lower-income communities. Lead is also highly toxic and associated with adverse health endpoints across virtually all body systems, including the nervous system, the cardiovascular system, the renal system, the immunological system, the hematological system, and the reproductive developmental systems in men and women, both in adults and children. Uranium occurs naturally in Earth's crust, which leaches into water systems through geochemical processes. Previous studies have shown that 74% of Americans have traces of the substance in their urine, and in the human body, it accumulates in the bone and the kidneys. Alpha radiation from uranium radioactive decay is classified as carcinogenic, and increasing epidemiological evidence shows that exposure to uranium in its metallic form is associated with chronic kidney failure and kidney disease, and neurologic, reproductive, and cardiovascular toxicity. The website New York Breaking News writes, according to data from the U.S. National Water Information System, 50% of domestic wells in the United States have detectable concentrations of uranium. The study says nitrate levels in water resources have increased worldwide from applications of inorganic fertilizer and animal manure in agricultural areas. The report adds, contamination sources also include septic systems that do not effectively remove nitrogen and discharges from wastewater treatment plants, as well as atmospheric deposition of nitrogen oxides and fertilizer use on lawns, golf courses, and parks. The team found that in 2019, about 5.6 million Americans were exposed to levels over the maximum limit. These levels were primarily detected in the Yakima Valley of Washington State and the San Joaquin Valley of California. Consuming too much nitrate can affect how blood carries oxygen and causes methemoglobinemia, when the hemoglobin can carry oxygen but cannot release it effectively to body tissues. These substances are derived from oil and gas extracted deep underground through wells. There are 150,000 active wells nationwide, and more than 9 million Americans rely on drinking water sources within 1 mile of these sites. Fracking fluids and wastewater from the process can contain toxic, radioactive, and carcinogenic chemicals. And the study notes that up to 4% of spills go unreported. Per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances are synthetic chemical compounds used in cleaning products, certain fabrics, non-stick cookware, and other items. According to the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, over 98% of the U.S. population has detectable levels of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances in their blood. According to the authors of the report, the highest levels of PFAS, per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances in drinking water, have been found close to industrial facilities, where per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances are manufactured or processed, and sites with discharges of aqueous film-forming foam, at military bases, at major airports and other fire training areas. The study shared that up to 80 million Americans get water that is tainted with high concentrations of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. In 2023, the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, estimated that from 70 to 94 million people in the United States are exposed to 6 per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances of concern in their drinking water at elevated levels. Black and white.
Una constante permanente en la historia de la humanidad.
A constant in the history of humanity, of small or large nations, is the struggle for sovereignty and independence, for self-determination, for their own development, self-government. Countries like Palestine, Yemen, Korea, Vietnam. We're talking about medium and small countries that have given an example of courage and fight against very poor enemies, such as imperialism and Zionism. In Latin America, we have a tiny country that is Nicaragua, which throughout the 20th century, with the people, started building a social and political leadership against this extremely powerful enemy that was the United States, obtaining a great victory in 1979 when the Sandinista Revolution came to power.
Cuando se instala en el poder la revolución sandinista, levantando las banderas.
Raising the flags of Augusto César Sandino, the leader, the man who at some point fought, even expelled North American imperialism and was assassinated from behind. That's how it is, how imperialism has acted. But these are moments, later superior moments, came of reconstruction, of construction, and Sandino's flags.
Y la bandera de Sandino, la bandera del sandinismo.
The flags of Sandinismo have marched like a cry for freedom, sovereignty, independence, throughout Latin America as a whole, leading from a small country. It has shown that profound transformation are possible, not only necessary, but possible, in this case, national and social liberation. And basically, that is, we are standing on our own feet.
Decir, estamos parados en nuestros propios pies.
Nicaragua is a small country. Today, it borders 7 million inhabitants.
But there's something about it that for some is a blessing, and others might consider it a curse. It has two ocean outlets, the Pacific Ocean and the Caribbean Sea. And that condition makes imperialism